Hi guys, welcome. My name is Mike Wilkerson. I'm with the University of Minnesota's HIV STI Intervention and Prevention Studies. HIPS, for obvious reason, it's just easier to say. Glad you guys are here. Our purpose today is to share with you some of our experiences that we've had in conducting internet-based research, both qualitative and quantitative. I will say, just as a disclaimer, these presentations obviously are limited in time, so we're just giving you a big picture overview. There's a lot of details that we're obviously going to be leaving out, but we're just hoping that you get some things to think about. So feel free to contact any of us after the presentation if you have more specific questions. We're happy to answer those for you. Let me tell you a little bit about what we're going to be talking about today. So leading off the talk today is going to be Dr. Horvath, and he is really great at medication adherence and using technology to encourage medication adherence for persons living with HIV. And so he's going to start with an overview of what is technology use in the U.S. and then talk specifically about a study that he's been working on with med adherence. And that's going to provide for you a really nice case example, if you will, before we get into the more lessons learned type activities. After Dr. Horvath, Dr. Ian Toffee is going to come up and talk to you specifically about recruiting and hidden populations. And so that's going to be a lessons learned talk rather than a database talk, if you will. And Dr. Ian Toffee has had a lot of experience with hidden populations. He began his research career working with persons with disability. He's also worked with persons who are transgender. He's worked with MSM populations, and he's getting ready to begin a study with deaf MSM, actually. So when it comes to recruiting hidden populations, he knows what he's talking about. And so I think that he'll have some good things for you there. He's also going to talk about protocols. You're going to hear throughout this presentation protocols, protocols, protocols. If you leave with nothing else today, that word hopefully will be burned across your forehead. Because one of the things that we think is really important is to have all of your protocols in place before your study ever begins. So he's going to talk about recruitment protocols. After that, I'm going to come up and talk a little bit about using online methods for qualitative data collection. And again, I'm going to really hit on protocols and why it's important to do protocols. And I'm going to talk a little bit, too, about when it's important to use online qualitative methods and when it might not be appropriate to use online qualitative methods. After my talk, we're going to take a turn, and we're going to move into quantitative methods. And we have two folks who are going to be talking to you about that. Jeremy Gray is a doc student. He's ABD in our shop, and he is great with data cleaning. He's gone back. He was using our data protocols and actually ran into some interesting challenges, if you will, that because the protocols were in place, he was able to quickly catch them and make sure that we ended up with a really nice, clean data set. So he's going to share that experience with you and then talk about, again, what protocols he did or how he modified our protocols, I should say. So that's going to be really informative. It's sort of a lessons learned with an oops, right? And you know we always learn the most from those. After Jeremy's talk, then Dr. Smolensky is going to come up, and he's going to talk about some latent variable analysis. He's an epidemiologist in our group who really has a specialization in quantitative methods. Because most of our talks are interconnected, I'm going to ask that you hold all of your questions until the end, and then after Dr. Smolensky's talk, I'll come up and we'll just do a Q&A. You can ask questions to anyone on the panel or to the panel at large. So just kind of make notes, and we'll do that at the end. All right? Welcome. So glad you're here. Yes, sir. Oh, yeah, I hear that.
Toward you.
Is this better? How's that? All right, fabulous. So one more thing before we get going. What brings all of us together? Well, we're part of HIV STI Intervention Studies. I told you that. And what does that mean? It's a group at the University of Minnesota. We're within the School of Public Health. And we're within the Division of Epidemiology and Community Health specifically. And we're a group of researchers and graduate students who are really interested in using technology to develop prevention programs for persons who are either living with or at risk for HIV or STI infection. So that's the common denominator in our team. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Horvath.
Thank you, Michael. You all are a very dedicated bunch. I'm really pleased that this is the first time I feel like I don't actually have to apologize for the weather in Minneapolis. So it is like this all year round. We'll just leave it at that. Okay, so as Michael said, my talk is a little bit different than other people's talk. And in fact, I think you guys are all talking about one study, and my study is a separate study. But either way, I think you'll get something out of it. My talk today is going to be focused on considerations in conducting formative research with your target population. And if you're developing a technology-based intervention, what are some of the things that we've done in our group to sort of try to understand our end users? And I want to recognize Jared Schenk, who is a co-author on this presentation and in the room. So thanks, Jared, for your really great work on the project. So I have three goals of this presentation. One is to review the relevance of technology to public health, and that should sort of set the stage for all of our talks. The second is to provide an example from my own research where we conducted a formative evaluation on technology use among people living with HIV, which also seems really relevant given the changing sort of goals and priorities of the CDC. And then providing really briefly some conclusions that we drew from our formative research to inform our intervention development. So, of course, people who, and I'm probably preaching to the choir right now, but a lot of people who may not have worked with technology-based kinds of interventions or research tend to ask, well, why do we care about technology? And one of the reasons I always provide is that it is, in fact, part of our U.S. national roadmap, and it's part of Healthy People 2020, which you know is the roadmap to improve the health and well-being of all U.S. citizens. And it has over 30 topics in Healthy People 2020, and health communication and health information technology is one of those topics. And it includes objectives like increasing the individual's access to the internet, increasing the proportion of people who use electronic personal health management tools, a number of people who use the internet to keep track of personal health information, communicate with their provider, have mobile and broadband access, and also the quality of health-related sites and the number of those sites that follow established usability principles. And of course, there are a lot of different technologies available to us in order to do intervention or to do formative research. That includes the old grandfather of them all, email, which I admit I am one of the people who still uses email. And so I imagine there might be a few other people left in the world that still do that, right? Yes, claps. The internet, mobile devices, e-readers, and of course specialized electronic monitoring devices. The Pew Internet and American Life Project, probably many of you are familiar with. It's a wonderful resource, and the goal of this project is to track technology adoption and use by U.S. adults in the United States over time. And as you can see in this slide, that there are a number of interesting trends, but most obvious is that devices that tend to be more mobile, like laptop computers, MP3 players, and ebook readers, are increasing in adoption, and stationary devices like desktop computers are going down in ownership. But when we look at the percentage of people who say that they have used the internet for any reason, the numbers are quite impressive. So 78% of all adults have used the internet at some point in their life, and there's no difference by gender, but there are some differences to be aware of by race and ethnicity. So, for example, African American persons are a little bit less likely to go online. People who are younger earn more money and have higher educational attainment tend to use the internet more often. And then people who live in urban centers report going online more so. And relevant to what I'll be talking about today, social networking site use, of course, is very popular. So we know that 65% of U.S. adults who use the internet also use social networking sites, and that amounts to 50% of all U.S. adults. And you'll notice on the right-hand side that the number of internet-using U.S. adults that say that they've used social networking sites has dramatically increased even in the last 6 years. And of course, people are going online for a variety of reasons. They're going online to, you know, post pictures and going online to connect with other people. Some people might be going online for other various activities related to porn, right? We all know that that's a very popular way people use the internet. But people are using the internet in important ways to seek health information. So 80% of internet users, or 59% of adults, have gone online to look for health information. And the most common thing that they do is they look for information about a specific disease or medical problem. They're also looking for information about certain medical treatments or procedures, but they're also looking for information about how to find doctors and hospital facilities, drug and safety, recalls, and 7% of people are looking for end-of-life care information. And so people are really using the internet for important things related to their health. So when keeping sort of that in mind, when we're thinking about trying to understand our target population to develop some interventions for, we, of course, if we have the time and the money and the resources, we want to conduct some kind of formative research. And in addition to all of the other reasons we would want to conduct formative research, like understanding the demographics of our users, understanding their risk behavior, we also want to understand what kinds of technologies that they're actually using, especially if we're going to be developing something that is going to be targeted toward those end users. In addition, I would argue that we really need to gauge the expectations of our users around similar types of technologies as we're developing for our intervention purposes. So I'm going to give you an example of that. The study that I'm talking about today is the Internet Medication Adherence Study, and the long-term objective of the study was to develop a theoretically grounded online social support intervention to improve adherence to antiretroviral therapy. And it's an R34 type of proposal, and it was funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. And I just want to take a very brief moment to acknowledge a really fabulous study team of investigators, consultants, research team that included Jared and our technology partner. And we had three aims of this particular study, and I'll focus on the first aim today, which was to conduct an online survey with follow-up online focus groups to assess social networking and mobile phone technology use among people living with HIV. But I just want to be clear, it was for the purpose of developing a theoretically grounded online social networking intervention to improve antiretroviral therapy for people living with HIV in AIM 2, and then in AIM 3 we assess the feasibility and acceptability of that intervention that we developed. And here is our study design for AIM 1. We use a sequential exploratory design, And we recruited a number of people into our online survey, but the people that we were most interested in were these two groups here, people who were in care and on antiretroviral therapy and either had very high adherence to their antiretroviral therapy, which of course is associated with it, with improved optimal virologic outcomes, or people who had lower adherence to their antiretroviral therapy. And then in that online survey, we had both quantitative and qualitative questions. And then we also conducted two online focus groups of people who reported lower adherence, just to kind of put some context around some of the things that we learned in the online survey. Just quickly, so the goals of AIM-1 were to determine if social networking sites were used by people living with HIV and which ones were used most often. And then in the second goal, we wanted to gauge their expectations about online social networking health websites and understand what features would they most like to see in a similar kind of website, and then what things would be barriers to engaging in an online social networking health website. And then the last one was we wanted to assess mobile phone adoption and frequency of use. So inclusion criteria were that people had to be 18 years of age or older, have an HIV positive status, which was self-reported, live in the U.S. and be English speaking. And as you can see here, we recruited people from a variety of different sources, but mostly people recruited online. And everybody, by the way, regardless of how they were recruited, completed the online survey. There weren't paper and pencil surveys. Moving on. So with the demographics, I'll just point your attention to this column here with the online survey. The mean age was 43. Most people had some college education, had been living with HIV for a little over 10 years. Most were male, white, gay, earned less than $30,000 a year, and were from urban, large sort of cities. And this is a pretty typical demographic profile if you don't sort of stratify by particular demographics like race and ethnicity. You kind of end up getting this kind of demographic. So in order to understand, you know, were people using online social networking websites, which was sort of the first step in this, we asked people, did you use social networking websites or features at least once a week? We wanted regular use. And I'll point your attention to this total column down here at the bottom. You'll notice that about a quarter of our sample basically said, no, we don't really, you know, we don't really use social networking websites or features once a week. But that left about three quarters of our sample who in fact did. Not surprising, of the people who did, most people said that they used Facebook, followed by pods.com, forums, MySpace. Apparently, this is when MySpace is, I don't even know, is MySpace still around? I don't even know, to be honest. The body.com forums and LinkedIn. And there were actually very few differences by adherence level, which was good, right? Because if we were going to tailor an intervention for people with lower adherence, we wanted to make sure that they weren't dramatically using online social networking websites less often than people with higher adherence. Perhaps more interesting is that we wanted to sort of get people's expectations about an online social networking health website. And so we just asked people in an open-ended question, describe your ideal online social networking health website. And we took their responses and coded them into different themes. And we came up with a number of things. So here they are. 45% of the responses said, we want it to be social, which was absolutely shocking, right? When you ask them, what is your ideal social networking health website, they say, hey, we want it to be social. So perhaps there's a priming effect there, right? But interestingly, 22% of responses had to do with information. They wanted relevant HIV information. 16% wanted the website to improve their emotional well-being. 13% recognized that they wanted it to be a welcoming space open to all people, but they also recognized that it had to be monitored to sort of keep out or at least keep people in check who might bring in a lot of negativity to it. 11% said that they wanted to find people who matched their specific circumstances, and 10% were concerned about confidentiality. So these things, you can imagine, what we learned from this directly impacts our intervention development, because we can say, okay, at the very least, our intervention has to sort of fit some of these expectations. What was interesting is we also asked them, you know, what would prevent you from participating in an online social networking health website? And many of the same things actually showed up. They were just sort of ordered in a very different way. So privacy and confidentiality rose to the top of that list of barriers. But then 14% of responses said, you know what, I just don't want to interact with, you know, in this way. And those would not be probably good candidates for an online social networking health intervention. There were some barriers that were very specific to actual barriers, which were lack of access. Some people were concerned about lack of access and the cost of gaining access to an intervention like that. So as far as mobile phone use, we wanted to gauge whether or not people use mobile phones, and then if they did, was the mobile phone one with a smartphone where you could access the internet or not? And you can see here, again, 13% of our sample did not own a mobile phone. And then the other people who did use a mobile phone, in fact, were evenly divided between those who had a smartphone and those who did not. So we had to be kind of careful about saying, you know, if we want to develop an intervention where people are accessing the internet online, it would be to a subgroup of the population. We also thought about whether or not they had an unlimited data plan, because we didn't have money to pay people for their data plan, and we wanted to know how often they access the internet on their phone. And so again, if you look at the total column here, about half of our population, sorry Alex, I won't try to take out your eyes, half of our population did not have an unlimited data plan and did not access the internet on their phone. And then about a quarter of our population did have an unlimited data plan and access the internet often on their phone. And then other people sort of fell in between. And then finally, of course, text messaging has become a really popular way to deliver intervention. And if you look again, look at the total column here, 19% of people who own phones said that they did not text message at all. But you'll notice down here at the bottom that if you take these two groups together, about a quarter of our population, in fact, sent 200 or more text messages in any given month. And so text messaging seemed to be a good way to reach a lot of people in our population. Okay, so let's end with conclusions here. So here's what we concluded from the formative research. Most people living with HIV responded to the survey use social networking sites regularly, including most people who reported lower adherence to antiretroviral therapy. And this was, of course, important because these are the people who we would want to ideally deliver these interventions to. The ideal online social networking health website for people living with HIV was one that would meet their social and informational needs, but also have some pretty strong privacy protections in them. And then texting and, to a lesser extent, web access via mobile technologies is widely used among internet-using people living with HIV. And so we really concluded, at least from our formative research, which was a good thing because we already had plans to develop an intervention, that targeting people living with HIV who use the internet that integrates social networking features, texting, and potentially to a lesser extent mobile phone technologies in terms of accessing the internet on their phone should have high acceptability. So, and with that, I'll end. Thank you so much.
Good morning. I'll be talking about how to recruit people online, and I will be drawing examples from the current study on which I'm project coordinator, which is the SAM study, looking at sexually explicit media and HIV risk, which was funded by the National Institute of Mental Health and for which Dr. Rosser is the PI. But I will also be drawing from example of past studies, both studies in which I've been the principal investigator or studies in which I've been involved as part of the research team. So I have several colleagues and past and present mentors that I kind of wanted to acknowledge before starting. So in the title, I talk about hard-to-reach populations. Sometimes people talk about hidden populations. But when we think about kind of hard-to-reach population, what do we mean? I mean, the most obvious meaning would be the populations that we cannot easily find online. We know that there is a certain demographic profile of internet users, and even though we know that a much wider range of people use the internet, it's not always obvious to know where to find them and how to engage them. And there's a very interesting kind of working paper by Dr. Brackert from Australia that really looks at this issue of hard-to-reach or hidden population. And she talks about how important it is to define your population and to understand, is it a population that's hard to reach because of demographic issues, for example, such as, you know, you're trying to reach maybe an older sample of internet users, or is it a population that you might want to define according to cultural or race characteristics? So, for example, are you trying to reach a population that speaks a language other than English but lives in the U.S.? Are you trying to reach a population that behaviorally might be hard to reach, such as undocumented workers, which might distrust providing any information even when confidentiality is assured, or, for example, meth using MSM, or any other kind of group that might have some behavioral characteristics that make it hard to reach or hidden. And then they might be hidden either because we're not looking for them, or they might be hidden because they do not want to necessarily be found online for various reasons. Or are there structural characteristics that we're looking at? For example, does your target population have less internet to less access to the internet from desktop devices and more access through text messages or smartphone or mobile kind of enabled devices? So all of those issues are worth thinking about, because often we can lump together this idea of kind of hard to reach population. So before talking about protocols, I wanted to think about which populations are we looking for and which characteristics define them. Because what it's important, it's also to prioritize which characteristics you're looking for. In my experience, it's really hard to reach everybody in a research study. I mean, maybe if we had unlimited resources, that would be possible. I've not been part of a study that has unlimited resources yet, unfortunately. So often prioritizing, obviously according to research purpose, is really important. And often that can be also kind of a painful process. You know, who are we really going after? And those are some really hard questions that we need to ask ourselves before recruitment starts. And often we talk about reaching populations online, doing online recruitment, but what does it really look like? Dr. Orbach already mentioned the email, the internet, but the precursor of the internet was email. I remember the days before we had the World Wide Web, and in fact, my very first study for my PhD did involve email only. And it's a really complex world out there nowadays. There are listservs, there are new social media sites and ways of connecting like Google+. There are individual websites, blogs, visually based social networks and text-based social networks. There are chat rooms. There are more niche online markets such as live journals, where there are much more almost like gated communities online, I would describe LiveJournal as. And although the use of LiveJournal has been declining, particular populations can be accessed there. For example, when I was looking for parents who were in polyamorous relationships, so they had more than one concurrent romantic and sexual relationship, LiveJournal was a really good way of recruiting people, because often some of the hidden populations stay hidden by creating those sorts of kind of online gated communities, for want of a better word. So it can be quite the landscape to navigate. And of course, the other thing to think about is how how is the population that you're targeting accessing the internet? So are they accessing the internet from laptop, desktops, gaming consoles? If you are going after a younger market, more and more young people are accessing their internet through mobile gaming devices or other gaming devices like PlayStations. And of course there are tablets, and then other issues to think about. Are you going after a PC-based technology or Apple-based technology? And particularly if you're considering using Flash for any of your adverts, those are all really important things to consider, and they have an implication on cost too. Because of course, recruiting often is not free, unfortunately. And even when it is, you still have to create the ads. And then after you've defined your population and you've decided where you're going to find them and you've decided exactly how they're accessing the internet or how they're likely to access the internet, there are online recruitment strategies to consider. Are you going for a passive recruitment? And here's an example of a banner that we've used on the current study that I'm coordinating. Or maybe you want to have a video campaign and see if it can go viral. So a previous study that was involved in All Gender Health Online, we created a YouTube channel and we had both ads for currently for the intervention they're piloting, and while I was involved for an online survey of non-transgender men who have sex with trans people, and we also had other content on the YouTube channel to engage people, and we had a YouTube video context and so on. Are you trying to reach people by email? Are you using a network that gives you, an advertising network that gives you access to several websites, such as Gay Ad Network, which we've done in one of those studies? Are you going to use Twitter? Because there is definitely a different population that uses Twitter. And if so, how are you going to manage the process of kind of tweeting or using other strategies? Are you going to try and do a snowball type of recruitment? And there's a little cartoon there by Calvin Hobbes. And how is that going to work? Is that going to give you a large sample of people who are like each other, or is it going to give you the sample that you want? So all of those are considerations to bear in mind when choosing your strategy. And maybe you want to have more than one strategy, depending on the population you're trying to reach. And if so, how are those strategies going to work together? And we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. So as well as all those, there are some more issues to consider. When I was preparing this talk, I thought, online recruitment, what is there to say about it? But obviously there was something to say about it, and I found myself considering even more issues. So once you have chosen your population, you've chosen your platform, you've chosen your strategy, other issues to consider are access issues, and I've already mentioned the digital divide, and maybe linguistic issues, not only for non-English speaking population, but also what does plain English mean, for example? What language are you going to use in your advertising? And that kind of goes together a little bit with public exposure too. For example, the current study, we're looking at sexually explicit media that most people often refer to as pornography or porn. What's going to happen if we put a study on porn with the University of Minnesota in the logo? What kind of public exposure is that going to attract? And now are we going to get ready for any potential public exposure in this country, where we know that this can become a heated issue, and it has in the past? Also, maybe the population that you're trying to reach is one of those population that might feel they're over-researched and under-resourced. And I know that's definitely an issue with many transgender communities, especially because this seems to have become such a hot topic with many researchers, including graduate students. And so often you can see very passionate kind of exchanges online about how people are really tired of taking part in research studies because then nothing changes and they still don't have any resources. And I see people kind of nodding in the room. So obviously this is, you know, that's one example, but I think there are several populations that feel that way. So there are issues around trust and credibility, and how do you build that when you're trying to reach populations online, and how do you do it in a way that you can go back to the different online environments again and again in a way which is credible and trustworthy as a researcher. And then how do you ensure that your sample is kind of consistent and coherent and can give you the data that you want to analyze? Because the online environment is really diverse. And also, if you're doing both online and offline recruitment, how is that going to affect your sample? And even if you're doing online-only recruitment and using a range of sources, how might that affect your sample? Are you trying to do any comparisons? And those are all things to keep in mind. I mentioned public exposure. And then, of course, tracking. Depending on how you're advertising, you may have more or less direct access to tracking directly where people are coming from. So being able to say, this percentage of my sample came through realjock.com, and this percentage of my sample came from Bear411, or whatever other sites you might be using to access your population, or from LiveJournal and so on. And then once you have kind of locked all this down, there is the overall study experience to consider. So I would invite you to consider, for example, the idea of branding your online study, especially if you're going for a variety of recruitment strategies on different platforms. It can become really important for potential research participants, but also for the public in general, to be able to recognize, oh yes, this is this study that I've seen somewhere else. First of all, this allows people not to take the study again by mistake and then kind of affecting your deduplication protocol, which is very important and which Mr. Gray will talk about in a moment. But it also kind of helps you build that trust and credibility with different population and with the public. So the idea of how do you brand your study? Do you have a logo, for example, that maybe it's recognizable, or do you have a kind of a shorter way to indicate your study? So we don't call the SAM study the understanding the effects of web-based sexually explicit media on HIV risk among MSM, because that would be really, really long for a recruitment ad or for a logo. The SAM study was a much better way to brand the study. And again, how do you communicate with participants? Do you have a coherent and consistent tone? Do you have protocols for your research staff so that no matter who's answering an email about, hey, where is my payment, or I've taken the study and then there were some questions about God and now I'm really worried that this is not a legitimate study, what's going on? And we're like, no, we're just using a spirituality scale because we thought that would be interesting. How do you communicate with your participants? What language do you use? What tone? Do you have an email dedicated to the study, for example, that can make a big difference? So all those are small details, but they contribute to the overall study experience. And how do you compensate your participants? A lot of people, if they're taking a study online, they have an expectation that they will be immediately rewarded. And we want to put deduplication protocols in place for a research study to make sure that every entry is unique. And again, you will hear about it in a moment. So compensation will not be immediate. How do you convey that in a way that's really clear? And how do you reinforce that in a way that's really clear if people get in touch with you? But also, how are you going to compensate people? Are you going to use something that maybe many people, but not all access? Are you going to use iTunes gift certificates? Are you going to use Amazon.com? Are you going to use PayPal? And if you do use PayPal, do you have a bank account that you can link? Because you need that to be verified, and often many workplaces might give you access to a credit card, but not an account that you can link. And those all seem very practical things, but they're all things to keep in mind, because when your coordinator or research staff is sitting there trying to get 150 people paid every day, that might make a big difference if they have to enter every email individually, or if they can upload a spreadsheet and pay people in 5 minutes rather than 5 hours. That's all going to affect your study costs too. And also, what are the expectations of your populations? What might they enjoy? Do you want to give them access to an online payment that ensures anonymity, such as giftcertificates.com, for example, but that then they can get sent to their home and use in an offline store? So all of those are part of the overall study experience. And finally, all of those kind of feed into your relationship with your IRB, so your institutional review board. How are you going to make sure that they understand the study experience that you're trying to give your participants and that they trust that? Because often with online studies, you have slightly less control than you might have with offline study, because people, you know, see your study, they repost it somewhere else, and before you know it, you've ended up maybe on a website like take surveys and make $20, you know, and you need to be able to track that. Or you might find that you have an IRB complaint because you were doing an online ethnographic study, which we did, and somebody was like, this is a safe space, and all of a sudden there is a researcher in the space. And even though we were authorized by the webmaster and we had been very clear about our presence online, this was, again, something that some people felt really strongly about, and so alerting your IRB immediately of any complaints and working with them is really important. So as we wrap up, Michael was saying the word that he wanted you to go away with was protocols. I would say it's documentation. Maybe it's because I've been a project coordinator for too long, but it's really important to have really great and clear documentation for your online study so that you can really ensure the credibility of your study when it comes to publication, for example, as well. I think there are still some doubts about the quality of internet-based research sometimes, so being sure that your recruitment protocol includes tracking, that you can tell in your paper, you know, how many impressions did we have on which website during which period of time, and how many click, you know, what was our click-through rate and so on. And other protocols need to be in place, like a communication protocol with your participant, an emergency protocol. What if a participant is really distressed? It's different if this is an offline project and you're right there with the participant and you can address it and you know all the local resources. But if I'm based in Minneapolis and somebody calls me from LA because they've taken our survey and they're really distressed, what is our procedure, and we do have one, to deal with this kind of emergency, and what is our procedures to deal with things like having our study splashed all across various papers, for example, and so on. And finally, like I've referred to before, deduplication protocols, I cannot stress how important they are, and we have a whole session dedicated to them. So that is all I wanted to tell you about online recruitment. It's probably more than you ever wanted to know. Should you want to know more, feel free to email me.
So Dr. Horvath gave you a case study. Dr. Ian Toffee talked a little bit about recruitment. I'm going to talk a little bit now specifically about qualitative data collection before we move into quantitative. And when I submitted the talk, this is the title I used, but really I think it's more important to clarify the title a little bit. So I'd like to add the idea that we're going to really just talk about online text-based focus groups and interviews for this conversation. There's an entire separate conversation about visual methods that we're really not going to hit on in this particular conversation. So that's just a small disclaimer. I'm talking about specifically the exact same study that Alex just mentioned, the sexually explicit media study. But like Alex, this is just our most recent experience with online data collection. I'm also drawing on past experiences as well. So just keep that in mind as we go forward. So in the literature, basically when we think about schemas for conceptualizing online qualitative data collection, there's essentially two ways that we think about it. One is the number of participants and the other is timing. When you think about the number of participants, it's very much like offline methods. Are you going to do an interview with one person? Are you going to do a focus group with groups of people? Pretty simple and straightforward. But then you also have to think about timing. And the timing, you can have synchronous, meaning that I'm in a real-time conversation with someone. Or it can be asynchronous, meaning that there's a gap in time with our conversation. And there's real implications for your data collection depending on which method you choose and your population. And we're going to get into that in just a moment. On this slide, I've just got a few typical examples of how we might use each of those. So it's very typical in an asynchronous interview, that's typically going to be email-based data collection. That's how we all kind of began this online data collection stuff back in the day. An asynchronous focus group is going to be message boards. Still very useful. We use those in the current SIM study. Synchronous interviewing, IMing, and then a synchronous focus group can be chat. You could expand that to Skype. I can talk a little bit about why you may or may not want to use Skype if you'd like. But those are some basic frameworks that we're going to be talking about in this conversation. So this slide's a nice one to start with, because if you look to the right there in the green, those are the reasons people always want to use online qualitative data collection. And in fact, if you stop with this slide, the positives clearly outweigh the negatives. But we're going to talk about some of the negatives in a moment, too, and we're going to try to give you a really balanced view so that you leave here with a clear idea of when I might or might not want to do it. So some of the reasons you might want to do it is it's potentially less expensive. Notice the word potentially. That's important because everyone says, oh, I can do this online data collection, and I don't have to pay for a room rental. I don't have to pay for refreshments. I don't have to pay for participant transportation costs. This is awesome. I don't have to pay for a transcriptionist, right? And I get a transcript that's error-free. If you guys have ever had a transcript from a transcriptionist where they've got that little block of line that says could not understand transcript, right? There's nothing that's more aggravating than to get that block of line in the middle of your transcript. You don't have that. That's not an issue. There's some other costs, though, you have to think about, and Alex alluded to that. Most importantly is recruitment cost. It's oftentimes more expensive to pay for banner ads or for other kind of advertising on certain websites. And if you're going for specific populations, for example, if you want to use a sex-seeking website, those are often very closed, they have a small market, and the cost is going to go up. Right? And you have to account for these costs. And that's oftentimes a lot more expensive than just going around to the local clinics and putting some flyers out. Right? So you have to balance those costs and really think that through, get some price estimates, look at different vendors who might access your population and figure out what's most affordable for me in my study. Some of the other reasons people love to do online qualitative data collection is because within your transcript, with every single comment, you're going to get a date and time stamp. That's really nice and really handy to help you with some of the synchronicity problems that you get. And we'll talk more about that in a little bit. But you can have some problems with syncing everything up, as you know, because so many conversations come in at once. You've got 8 people typing. It's not going to be a perfect streaming flow. And those date and time stamps can help. The other nice thing about it is that you can link your attributes, participant attributes, or characteristics, if you will. Attributes is an in vivo term. You can easily link those attributes into your qualitative data analysis software, into your QDAS, right? Because everything is linked up with a participant ID. That's beautiful. That's wonderful. And that really helps your analytic power. And you can't always do that as easily with a verbal transcript, right? How many times have you been trying to transcribe a focus group and you're like, all right, there's 4 people in the room. Whose voice was that? Do I assign that to participant 1, 2, 3, or 4, right? Because that participant didn't say, I'm Joe, before they began their comment. They just talked. Not a problem. So these are some of the reasons that people love to do online qualitative data collection. Also, you need to collect less personal identifying information. I can do an entire qualitative data collection and never know the person's name and never know their address. And I don't even have to know necessarily their real email. They can give me an email address that they set up on Yahoo or Hotmail just for this study. So their PID is really protected in some ways. Now, what I will capture, I'm going to capture their IP address. So make sure you put that in your consent form. Chances are you're going to capture that. And there are some other things you might want to capture. We'll talk about that. The dark side to this, or the first dark cloud, I would say that you need to consider, is staff training. Do not underestimate staff training. It can be particularly important for 2 reasons. Number 1, in addition to being trained on qualitative data collection, they also have to be trained on the technology you're going to use. So if I am someone who is very comfortable with email, but we're going into a chat room to do this data collection, maybe I'm not the best guy to collect the data for this study, or I need to get really trained on chat rooms before I do it. And so that can be a real challenge. Some population considerations. Alex kind of touched on this a little bit. There are populations who use technology less, and some who use it more, and it gets even more specific if you start thinking about the particular delivery method. So, for example, if I want to recruit older people and I want to use technology, perhaps email is okay because a lot of older folks use email. I may not want to IM. In comparison, if I'm doing a bunch of younger folks, I'm probably not going to think twice about using IM or chat. In fact, they might prefer that than having to come to a room. Right? So that's something to really think about and to consider. You also want to think about your connection speeds. So for example, we use Adobe Connect quite a bit for our qualitative data collection. And Adobe Connect has some really beautiful and amazing features in terms of a whiteboard where participants go and draw. I can import a YouTube video. I could link them to a website. There's a lot of great things I can do with that particular software package, as well as some security features that it has. However, if I am asking my participants to go in and view a YouTube video and they have a really slow connection speed, that's going to bog them down, right? If I'm asking them to go in and use a whiteboard and they've never used a whiteboard before, they might just decide not to participate in the study. They're like, I'm done. And they're going to close the window and I've lost that participant. So these are things that you have to think about in terms of your population and making sure that just because you've got this cool, snazzy tool, you've got to take that cool, snazzy tool and make sure it matches your population. And that can be a real challenge, both in terms of connection speeds and in terms of the tools that you're going to use with them. One of the advantages that online methods offers is that it's not geographically bound. If I want to do a focus group here in the cities, chances are I'm going to get folks who live in the cities, right? That's just the way it is. No one from Bemidji or from Madison is probably going to come participate in my focus group. But I can go online and have someone from New York and Puerto Rico in my focus group. That's pretty fabulous, right? So those are nice things to think about. The other nice thing about it is that if you go into visual methods, you can recruit and use people who may have visual impairments. However, you need to keep in mind, if you're doing text-based methods, you could potentially be discriminating is probably the wrong word. I'm not sure the word I want to use here. But you're creating a barrier for folks with visual impairments with text-based methods oftentimes. Some other considerations to be aware of. Participants love the fact they don't have to travel. That's really great. They love that. However, they could also be sitting in their living room with a beer in their hand, the TV going on, and chatting with their girlfriend while they're trying to participate in your study. So it's not really an ideal situation for reflexivity. You don't have their attention as much as you might want, and that's a real challenge and something you've got to think about as you structure your focus group. How am I going to keep these people engaged, right? One of the nice things about this type of work, though, is that oftentimes there is more participant confidentiality because, as I already mentioned, you're getting less PID. And also, it's kind of nice because all the research suggests that participants have more sense of anonymity because they create a user pass or user ID that they made up. And there's perceived group homogeneity. I perceive that everyone in this group is like me. Right? I might be the only middle-aged white guy from East Texas in the entire group, but in my brain, everyone in this room is a middle-aged East Texas white guy. Right? That's pretty fabulous because I'm going to feel comfortable to disclose more. From the researcher, that's pretty fabulous. Now, you also have to think about the pros and cons of that disclosure, and you have to think about within your focus group, how am I going to handle someone who over-discloses? Because it's a little trickier to think about over-disclosure when someone's typing away and they hit enter and there it is. Right? Oftentimes we don't have those verbal cues. And that's a real challenge and something we have to think through. I read an article that I thought was really an interesting experience. It was a lessons learned from another researcher who was doing some online qualitative data collection. And one of their participants copied their data, the entire conversation, and posted it to a blog. And that blog just happened to be one of the places that researcher was recruiting from. And so guess what? A lot of future participants now read all the questions. The entire study was tainted. So that's a risk. That's something you have to be concerned about, something that you have to think through. How am I going to inform my participants before the study begins that this is not their information? And to be respectful of that, and to hope that they respect that, right? Be aware of that. I can't remember if it was the same article or another article, but another article, there was actually a researcher who came in to the study and kind of near the end of it disclosed that they were a researcher and wanted to copy the data and use it for their own paper. And so you have to be, like, people kind of think some differently. They don't, the rules get messy, if you will, in an online environment. And so you have to think that through and really be clear with people the expectations and help them think it through and set those boundaries. Of course, you can also have technological problems. And so one of the things that I would recommend, I don't care if your software has a record button. That's fine and dandy. Make sure that you've got someone sitting next to you copying and pasting and saving the entire conversation in a Word file the entire time. Because all software crashes every now and then. And if your website crashes right in the middle of your record session, you just lost it, or potentially lost it, or at least lost a part of it. So always, always copy, paste, save. You can always delete that Word file later if you don't need it, but that's kind of a good CYOA. Few other data collection considerations to think about. We already mentioned, you can incorporate multimedia. Incredible conversation can come from this, right? I can pull in, like I said, a YouTube video. I can pull in media ads, have a conversation. If I want to talk about different HIV prevention ads across the country, fine, easy to do. I can pull up San Francisco's ads, pop them out there, show them to them. I can show the HIV test stuff that just came out. I can show them that. I can go over to New York and show them what's happening there. Compare, contrast, easy, easy to do, right? Copy, paste, import it in, show them the link. Beautiful stuff, much easier to do than in an offline situation. I can also offset the fact that I can't always see people's facial expressions with the use of emoticons and the thumbs up and thumbs down. Now, if you want to use that, make sure you tell people at the beginning, sort of in your ground rules, hey, use the emoticons, let me know if you agree. Right? And remind people throughout the conversation, because some people are really into using emoticons and some people it's just not part of their world. Right? But that can help offset a little bit. The other thing that's really nice, depending on your software package, in Adobe Connect, for example, they have polls. And I love using polls because you can get an instant read on what people think about a topic. So let's say you're having a conversation about, birth control, right? Should birth control be available in high schools? I'm just making this up, right? Should the nurse be able to give it out, right? You want to do a quick poll and find out if people support that idea? Boom, you can instantly pull it up. You can see the entire group's responses aggregated and ask them about that. Do you like that? Do you not like that? What do you think? Fabulous. Great way to have conversation. So a lot of advantages there. Again, some more dark side considerations to think about. You cannot always guarantee security. I don't care if you're using SSR, if you're doing HTTPS. I don't care what security features you have in place. Someone will go in and hack it if they really want to. Right? There are computer people out there that can just get into the data. So you cannot guarantee it. So make sure that's in your consent form. But of course, work with your IT folks to make sure it's as good as you can get it, right? It can be more difficult to build rapport, and there are strategies to help build rapport, including modeling how to introduce yourself. Begin with some small chat in a waiting room. If you can have a waiting room before you begin your data collection, do some small chit-chat in that waiting room. You know, oh, you're in LA. How's the weather in LA? It's snowing here in the cities, you know, whatever. Just build some conversation, get them comfortable talking to you and to each other before you begin the focus group. That'll help build rapport. So synchronous, asynchronous specific issues. The synchronous, a positive, it more closely resembles face-to-face. A negative, a lot of cognitive load for both you and your facilitators. I'm sorry, your participants and your facilitators. a lot more cognitive load. They're having to read a transcript, and if it's a chat room, they're reading a bunch of people's typing at the same time, processing that information, thinking about your question, formulating a response, and typing it in at the same time that other people are doing exactly the same thing. So cognitive load is difficult for both you and for the participants, which is why we always recommend 3 staff persons when we're collecting our data. We always have 1 staff person who's doing the tech work, we have 1 staff person who's facilitating the conversation, and another staff person who is reading the transcript sitting next to the person who's facilitating to help think about those big picture questions and to develop probes. Asynchronous focus groups encourage more reflexivity. There's a loss of spontaneity, right? Also, asynchronous can allow the participants to respond on their own time, which is really a nice benefit to participants, and can help you as a researcher if you're doing the constant comparative method. However, it can also be a challenge if you want to go back and do follow-up. No greater challenge than it would be in an offline situation when you're doing follow-up, because oftentimes participants forget the context in which they made their original comment, and so when you ask for clarification, they're like, I don't really know anymore. I don't know why I said that, right? Most of us can remember a situation in which we made a comment and then later we're like, I'm not really sure what I was thinking right then. Maybe I was thinking this, right? We've all done that. And that's more of a problem with asynchronous than synchronous. So some trade-offs. So those are some things to consider. Let's talk protocols. These are specific things I would recommend you put in your qualitative data collection protocol. Start off with your study aims, specifically the qualitative aim, but include all the aims so that you can remind yourself at the top of the protocol or your staff. Remember, the protocols are not just for you, they're for your staff too. So at the top, how does this qualitative aim connect with all the other aims in the study, right? Detail your recruitment strategy. Think about all the issues that Alex brought up and detail exactly what you're going to do. That means if you want your staff to send an email as soon as there's a schedule, if you want them to send an email a week before, a day before, if you want them to send a text message reminder, whatever you want them to do, write it out so that you have some standardization across participants. Have all of your protocols detailed right there. Your guidelines for using your instruments, again, you want standardization. If I have everyone on this platform facilitating at different times, I want to make sure that if Keith is facilitating the day before me, that there is some similarity in our data, right? So have some guidelines for how you're going to use those instruments and train your staff on those guidelines and do some mock groups before you begin to make sure that it's consistent. We already talked staff and responsibilities a little bit, but make sure they're really clear with the 3 staff. Make sure you obtain consent. In our shop, we've developed a chunk consent process. Consent can be really cumbersome because in addition to the usual consent stuff, now you've got to add on online consent. So consent can get really tricky. Dr. Rosser actually wrote a paper on consent that if anyone's interested, we can email it to you for the process we use for chunk consent. Just send an email to us and we'll forward it to you. Think about your retention strategy. That goes back again to the recruitment strategy, emails, et cetera, text messages. One of the things that we found is at first we were just using some emails, and we had a huge loss in participants. We recruit, by the way, if we want 8 people in a focus group, we recruit 16. We expect on a 50% dropout rate. Okay, 50% dropout. But you can help that if you send a text message the day before. That does require that you're getting, in addition to an email and an IP address, you're now capturing a phone number. So not everyone's going to want to give you that, but it helps. And ask them, of course, if they want text. Some people may not. And in our text, it doesn't say, oh, by the way, don't forget you got a porn focus group tomorrow. It says, as a reminder, you're enrolled in a University of Minnesota study at 10 a.m. Very generic. Data safety monitoring plan, we've alluded to that quite a bit. Mr. Gray is going to hit on that really hard in a minute. It's a really great conversation. I'm not going to hit on it, but trust me, you want a good one, and he'll explain why. Incorporate your analytic plan into your protocols. The reason I say that is because if you've written your entire protocols and you get to this step, it gives you a chance to go back to the study aims, go back to your recruitment strategy, go back to everything that you're doing to make sure that you're going to meet your study aims and that you can analyze the data that you want to, right? If you've got your recruitment strategy, your instrument guidelines, it's sort of a check and balance. And you've basically at that point written out exactly what the study's going to look like before you begin. It's just a good check. And chances are, if you've written a grant, you've already thought a lot of that through, but it's good to put it in place for your staff as well. Oops, wrong way. Compensation, make sure you, Alex hit on compensation. I'm not gonna touch on that, but make sure you talk about how you're gonna compensate as well. Other protocols, Alex already hit on these. You need a really clear referral protocol. Make sure that if someone calls me from LA that I know how to give them a referral. Doesn't matter that I live in the cities. A communication protocol, again, you need to make sure that you know how am I going to communicate with the participant and with my IRB and my administration if I have a reportable event. That's usually what we mean by a communication protocol, and that includes drafting templates of responses of what could happen, just so that you're really clear on what's going to happen, and think it through, and think through who is going to respond in each of these situations. Because chances are, there are certain staff that are more qualified to deal with certain situations than others. And then lastly, an emergency protocol, that's really a political protocol. If you get a contact from the media or from a legislature, we do sex research. Chances are, at some point, someone's going to get a little persnickety, and we need to have a plan and have thought through before we get the phone call from Channel 11 about how we're going to answer potential questions that they might want to ask, right? Thanks.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jeremy Gray. I'm a PhD student at the University of Minnesota in epidemiology and a research assistant on the study that most of us have been referring to today. The point of my talk is to go through our data monitoring plan, which involves deduplication and checks for fraud. So jumping right into it, to check for fraud, you really have to consider elements during the survey design phase, monitoring the data while you're collecting it, and then also taking it into account when you prepare to clean your data and analyze it. So first we'll define fraud, then talk about what you need to think about when developing your survey, then how you use both software and manual inspection in order to determine which cases are potentially fraudulent, and then examine what influence that would have on your findings, and finally the limitations of it, because there's no way to absolutely identify everyone who's trying to get one over on you in order to get whatever incentive you're offering. So first, to define fraud, it's kind of a charged word. I know my advisor, Dr. Rosser, and I have discussed that most people don't like the term fraud being thrown around, so you can call it misrepresentation or suspected ineligibility, but really it's people who gain access to the survey by pretending to be something that they're not. And really a big thrust of this presentation will be how we determine within a reasonable, how we rationalize that people are probably trying to lie their way into the survey. So during the survey development phase, you want to make sure that you collect a few key pieces of information. Our fraud detection protocol is based on a little bit of work on detecting repeat completers. But we extend that a little bit by looking to see if people change their answers in order to gain access to the survey. So that's how it goes beyond just people who try to complete the survey many times to people who are probably beyond our population of interest. And to do that, we use both eligibility screener items and then items that we put into the survey to verify that they were telling us the truth when they gained access to the survey in the first place. So all these data are from the SEM study, PI Dr. Rosser, this is our grant number, from the National Institute of Mental Health, and the data were collected last year from May to July. Our eligibility criteria were simple. They had to be male, age 18 or older. They had to have had sex with a man in the last 5 years, and they could not have taken the survey previously. So here, repeat completers were, by definition, ineligible anyway. This is what our eligibility screener looked like. You can see it was just simple questions. All of our eligibility criteria are involved in there. And then what we don't have a screenshot of is whatever responses they put into the screener were projected back to them, and they were asked to confirm it. So that's how we got around people who maybe clicked the wrong answer. On the next page, it would say, you'd said that you were male, living outside of the U.S., and had sex with only women in the last 3 years. And if they verified that, they were then, if they were ineligible, they were ejected from the survey. So we could see if they then came back and tried a new set of responses in order to get in. So as I said before, we not only had the screener questions, but we also had items within the survey and items that were automatically collected by our survey software, such as IP address and timestamps, in order to determine if what they said in the screener was true or if we suspected that it was true. So for instance, for age, we had a categorical age item in the screener, and then at the end of the survey, we asked them what their age was. They said that they were U.S. resident. We then looked at their IP address and also the address that they listed for payment for the survey. We offered, I think, $25. And also whether or not the zip code that they provided was valid, according to an up-to-date zip code list. We also had items within the survey about their sex partners. If they told that they hadn't had sex with a man, that was a flag. And also, well, we had no confirmation of gender, but IP address was also a way for us to see if they had attempted to take the survey previously. So using those variables, it was easy to develop a code in Stata to automatically flag anyone whose responses were incongruent. We immediately had a database that would output with anyone whose zip codes didn't match up, if their IP address was from outside of the United States. We used an IP database that included latitude and longitude. This is not where they were competing from, but where their internet service provider is, so that it wasn't incredibly invasive. We weren't getting like their house or anything like that. But we plotted that on maps instantly, so we could see quickly if anyone was responding from outside of the U.S. And then we also used, and as I said, we used databases for IP and zip code. The results of that are that most people who accessed the survey were eligible in at least one of the criteria. You know, 97% of them were men, according to what they said. Only 4% were under the age of 18, and so forth. So summarizing that, but if you look across all of them, only 65% of the people who completed the items on the screener were eligible. And we had a large people from outside of the U.S. And this was puzzling, and this is why it's very important to monitor your data while you're collecting it. We were only projecting our ads to people with IP addresses within the U.S. So after we noticed that we were getting a high number of people from outside of the U.S., we decided to contact Gay Ad Network, who was broadcasting our ads, and they realized that they had accidentally broadcast it to the entire world. So I think this map, see if you can figure when we caught our mistake. This is a time lapse of the first 3 weeks of our data collection. These are people who accessed our screener. And you can see it's all over the world, and then it just stops. So that's, I think that illustrates pretty well why you should monitor your data regularly, because you can see very clearly when it's not only advertising to the people that you want to access your survey. And I think some of the other criteria were surprising, too. We had, you know, most of them were men, but some of them said that they hadn't had sex with anyone in the last 3 years, and we only, you know, you think if you advertise only to gay websites in the U.S., you won't get 15% of people from outside of the U.S., which we figured out why that was, but still, it was clearly reaching people outside of our target population. I know that on a study that Alex and I worked on previously, we were recruiting transgender persons, and the recruitment was going very slowly, and all of a sudden overnight, we had about 200 people access our survey, and we realized by looking at the referring URL, and that's another key thing to look at to detect fraud, that someone had posted it to slickdeals.net and told people that if they completed the survey, they could get $60. And they put the eligibility criteria, and they were able to get in. And although we were very happy that we recruited, we had to throw out all of those responses. So ultimately, this is a plot of the people who viewed our screener. These are the people who said that they were U.S. residents, so there were a few liars outside. And then the people who actually made it all the way through the screener and attempted, they started our survey, not necessarily completed. Fewer people than not. So this dot here is not an island. It is if people didn't have an IP address. So if it was blank, if they used, say, a proxy or somehow masked it, that's what that dot is. So that's zero latitude and zero longitude. I discovered that after I made the maps. So these are views from IP addresses. Now, it's inflated because people might have viewed the survey, the screener, and then decided they were going to take it later. So a lot of these might be the same people. These are attempts, so people who completed the screener, so you can see it drops down right away. 1,200 people had one attempt from the same IP address, then 120 from two attempts from the same IP address, and you get someone who tried 16 times from the same IP address. And these are completions. So again, that person who attempted 16 times also sent 16 complete surveys. Which, that's an immediate flag, and that's someone that we immediately deem to be at least a repeat offender, not offender, but someone who attempted to take the survey multiple times. But if it seems that they were genuinely eligible the first time, we discussed it and we decided to keep their first response, because if they are a member of our target population, their data are still important. So then looking at our verification of age, MSM status, and geography, well, we just looked at geography. Age was pretty consistent overall. You know, 96% of people in between 95 and 100% of people in each age category were being honest. people who said that they lived in the USA, 98% had US IP addresses. Interestingly enough, 9.3% of the people said they lived outside of the US also had a US IP address. So we don't know exactly why that is. I don't know why they would deliberately be ineligible for the study, but so be it. Male partner confirmation, 99.5% of people said that they had had sex with all or some men during the past 5 years, so they were telling the truth about that. So beyond that, once you have these automatic flags generated, once you see that people's responses aren't congruent, you then have to go into the data, and there are some considerations. So some of the issues aren't as cut and dry as you think. Duplicate IP addresses are not necessarily disqualifying. If you look at our target population, many men, whether they're partners or just roommates, many men from the same target population may be accessing from the same computer. So we duplicate mailing addresses, again, partners and men who live together. Mismatched zip codes, if they completed from different different places, you know, if they were starting it from work and then at the end we asked them where they live, they gave their home zip code. That doesn't necessarily mean that they were lying. And the time taken to complete the survey, we initially had a criterion that they had to take longer than about a half an hour, but less than like 3 hours. But then some people must have left the window up overnight, so we had people who took 36 hours. We had people who completed it in 20, but because of skip patterns, it was completely feasible. So a lot of these issues we couldn't just determine automatically. And Alex was wonderful to go in and do most of the dedupe, but the thing you want, but I know I certainly did some, and we had other people come in to make sure that what we deemed as fraudulent was consistent across raters. So you want to make sure you have some of that inter-rater liability when you're determining fraud. We just certainly discussed certain things where, you know, are these responses plausible? Does it sound like these might be partners or roommates? You know, and one by one for the 200 some odd, which I think I have the actual numbers, for the people that were flagged as ineligible, we confirmed that by going into the data and examining it more closely. Again, this is one of the massive spreadsheets that output. There is no identifying information in here in case someone just gasped, you know, was worried about, you know, names or anything like that. These are all de-identified. I hid anything that would be incredibly identifying. But these were the spreadsheets that we had to go in. And so everyone who was flagged using our automatic protocol was then output to a spreadsheet such as this, with codes indicating why they were flagged and with the responses related to those codes. So such as duplicate IP address or non-US IP address. And as I said, I've already covered these. People also make mistakes. Again, we tried to reduce that by confirming their answers before they access the survey. And I guess one of the things I didn't mention, we had people immediately access the screener from our banner advertisements, and we didn't collect any information from them. So we had them complete the screener, confirm their answers, and then go right into our consent and complete the survey. If you're doing anything where you collect a lot more information, it might be easier to verify identity. We determined that it would be better not to collect all the extra information to violate, well, because of the risks of violating confidentiality. So after we went in and inspected the responses, we decided that 84 of them were suspicious. So 30% of the people who were flagged, only 30% of the people who were flagged using the automatic protocol were actually suspicious cases. So then looking at the data, if we hadn't caught these people, if we had left them in, how do their responses differ from the people who we determined to be legitimate participants? And if you look, If you look at the 95th percentile and greater for some of the variables that we're very very concerned with in our research, either lifetime number of partners or last 90 days, a higher proportion than would be expected were from people who we found, determined to be from people we determined were probably lying in order to access our survey. So 30% of the people above the 95th percentile lifetime number of sexual partners were from the suspicious cases. And same thing with unprotected anal intercourse, both receptive and insertive. A higher proportion than would be expected were from the suspicious cases. So for surveys that aren't taking the time to look at potential ineligibility, to look at fraud, they may be overestimating some of these counts, some of these frequencies. Limitations. Hackers will always get through. People can use IP proxies if they're accessing from outside of the U.S. People who even took the time to see our banner advertisements might even know the eligibility criteria and get it right the first time. Because really, we were only getting people who didn't get it right the first time and kept trying until they finally got in. We can't really confirm gender unless they, again, unless they put that they're female the first time they attempt it and then change it to male for subsequent times. And just because they're eligible, just because we determine that they're eligible, it doesn't mean that their data are valid. It's just something else to take into consideration during data analysis and cleaning. So thank you to my advisor and the principal investigator, Dr. Rosser, our computer expert, Joe Constand, Derek, who is the head of the data analysis team, the coordinator, Alex, and Sanan, who was our web programmer and really helped us catch a lot of these people, I think. So thank you.
All right. I am last and certainly least, and I know I stand between y'all and lunch, so out of self-preservation, I will be pithy. My presentation is taking a bit of a departure from the tenor of the others, where it was focused on issues around data collection, data cleaning, making sure things look good. I'm now going to say, all right, you have your hypotheses, you have your data, and you're going to sit down and you're going to wave your hands over the box and get some output and call it a day. What happens when things don't exactly work the way you anticipate? You know the study, you know the people. I, for whatever reason, conferred an MPH to Jeremy when it really should be an MA, but that's beside the point. So my focus is on issues of heterogeneity. And so we're going to talk a bit about exactly what I mean by heterogeneity, and then we're going to look at an application of this issue in the context of the sexually explicit media study. So yes, we will finally talk about porn. So first off, when you go into data analysis and you're attacking it, you're going to make one of two assumptions. Either your sample represents a homogeneous group of people so that any parameters that you're finding apply across the broad spectrum, or there's heterogeneity with known indicators for it. So you stratify a sample by race, ethnicity, by gender, by age, because you expect a difference in prevalence, or you expect a difference in the valence and magnitude of a regression coefficient. If you don't take those things into account, then you could end up with biased overall estimates. Well, because I took one too many classes in my graduate training, I now know that a lot of heterogeneity can be unobserved because, you know, God forbid we ever do anything concrete, we have to have something ethereal. So you now are approaching a data analysis set where you have the potential for distinct groups of people in your data and you don't have a specific variable that says who they are. How do you find them? What do you do with them? What are they doing to your analysis if you don't take them into account? A contemporary approach and where sort of the methodological literature is heading right now is in the world of latent class analysis. This is just souped up cluster analysis. So you're going more from a maximum likelihood perspective as opposed to just focusing on substantive criteria. I've only done 2 minutes. I've got six more. The big difference between this and some other things that are part of the general latent variable framework is that you're usually dealing with categorical indicators and you're going to identify a categorical latent variable. But it can be extended, of course, because that's what methods people do. We can do it with nominal, ordinal, continuous indicators. You could even draw pictures of something like that. We can play with it. A big distinction, then, in terms of what you're going to get in your output. Assuming homogeneity of structure, of content, so it's the same construct, but people differ in terms of just degree, you get the factor analysis model, where you have this assumed underlying normal distribution that accounts for the variance in your data. If you're taking the other tack, where you're going to say, you know what, I think there are discrete groups that differ not just in magnitude, but in kind, so that it's not the same factor, but it's a different setup of responses, you end up getting different group categorizations. And that's how you can then identify whether or not homogeneity is in your sample. So, in the sexually explicit media study, the primary hypothesis was that among men who have sex with men, and I do note the small irony in talking about heterogeneity in a sample of primarily homosexual men, it just, you know, it's life. So exposure to more, basically, the long story short, the more you're watching porn, the hypothesis was, is the more you are practicing risk behavior. And as an ancillary to that, the idea was it's not just watching porn, but specifically porn geared toward the lack of condom use in its depiction, or what they would call bareback sim. Well, here's the rub. Bareback and safer sex, anal sex porn are ubiquitous amongst gay men. I don't know why, I don't know how, it just is. And so coming up with a really clean, precise distinction between those who are and are not watching it is going to be at best somewhat artificial. And it may not accurately portray what's really going on. And so my question is, are there other things that we have measured related to content that could do a better job delineating differences between distinct groups of people? So, first off, the sample, much like Dr. Horvath showed with the Pew Internet, we have young. Our proportion of white non-Hispanic is a little lower than you would have expected, but that's an artifact of the design of the study. We deliberately sampled by race ethnicity categorization to try and increase diversity within the sample. Pretty educated, a low prevalence of HIV positives, about 40% in a relationship. The dosimetry that you'll see below, I'm using two forms of dosimetry for porn. They're both in terms of hours per week. One is a log transform continuum. The other is a categorical, so basically a low exposure, up to about a half hour a day, about an hour a day, and then more than an hour a day, which frankly, y'all got a lot of time on your hands. Ooh, that was a bad one to use. Moving forward. We took 15 items that measured a range of possible behaviors that people were watching when they engaged in any given session of pornography over the last 90 days, used a 5-point Likert type measure that we could then bounce against with the dose to get an idea of exactly how much SEM content relates to each of these items. For your viewing pleasure, we have the list, and I'm presenting from that Likert, so 1 being not at all, to 5 being always, where we're basically seeing the measures of central tendency for the items. For the top half, from kissing down to anal sex without a condom, pretty typical. Little variability, a little lower on cum swapping, which is also known as snowballing. Did I just win a bet for saying that? Anyway, and then you'll see at the bottom of it, though, that basically spanking to water sports, what would be considered more from sexological jargon, paraphilic or more extreme behaviors, are being endorsed a lot less often by our sample. And so a priori, I could easily see two groups forming within our data, where you have kind of a prototypical set of what I would expect to be standard fare, and then there are probably some people that are pretty interested in the set that comes in at the play at the bottom. Well, to do the latent, this is a latent profile model. I'm using the 5-item ordinal as the outcome, so I'm going to retain as much variability in the data as I possibly can. Did a split sample calibration and validation to make sure that I'm not just modeling a bump or a wart. And we come up with basically 2 profiles statistically looks the best. Good entropy, so that's good classification quality. Closer to 1 is better. The p-value for the likelihood ratio test is significant, which says it's better than no profile at all. So heterogeneity wins over homogeneity. You look at 3 profiles in both groups. The information criteria get a bit better. Entropy goes down a little bit. And the likelihood ratio tests are telling us that we're probably overdoing it a little bit. Let's back up. But before we draw conclusions, let's take a look at what is the story we get. because aside from just statistical criteria, I've been beaten enough times in the literature to know that you have to take in the interpretive stance. So, if we go with the two-profile solution, the light blue is showing us the dominant profile in the data. So, kissing and oral sex, the anal with and without a condom are the two areas where you're spiking, really, really low on the extreme items at the far end, and a little bit of variability with toys, dildos, the occasional fist. And then there's the more extreme group, which I'm just calling kink now for shorthand because I lack creativity, and we see that they're sort of running the gamut from mild to wild. If we looked at the three-profile solution, what I find interesting here is we retain the kink group, but then the other two groups that it's showing me are not necessarily difference in kind, but difference in magnitude. And this is what you would expect if it were actually just a single dimension that we're now trying to break apart in terms of magnitude. So it becomes a question is, are those legitimately three different groups, and is the juice worth the squeeze? Does making a more complex model tell us something more about the data, or like the statistical criteria suggesting, we might be overcooking the books? So I chose to go with the two-profile solution, and the idea was now, okay, this is what we have, but I can't use a single indicator back in a fixed effects model and say this is now my new indicator for a potential interaction, because I would be ignoring the variance from modeling who's in what group. It's probabilistic. Not everybody's in that group and it's a perfect assignment. So we have that variability plus the variance in the other data, and we have to take all of it into account. So what you'll see sometimes in the literature is people will create the binary variable saying one class or the other and then run it in a model and call it a day. And that actually is a big no-no because you're ignoring variability, thus giving yourself slightly better looking results than you could really expect. The other way to do it, if you suffer from social problems like I do, is to try and build your regression model simultaneously with a classification model so that you can basically take your computer and hope it doesn't overheat. So I did exactly that. I threw in our risk behavior indicators of the outcomes and used a negative binomial regression because they're distributed as counts. We also have a variable we created, which is whether or not people are engaging in serodiscordant unprotected anal intercourse. This would be the big indicator for the potential for transmission risk. Put all three outcomes in the model, run it in the context of the latent class model, and you do it two ways. One in which the regression coefficients are free to see if there's any difference between our identified groups, and another where you constrain them to see if that hurts the model at all. That's becoming your test of moderation or effect measure modification, depending on your PhD area of focus. So if we look at the main associations without taking into consideration at all any homogeneity, we see the modest association between either the log transformed or the categorical dose measure of porn at the higher ends with unprotected receptive anal intercourse. And not a whole lot going, marginal at best, for the other two outcomes. When you do the coefficients now separately within these classes that we've identified, we see that the story changes up a little bit between them, but that overall, they're not all that different. So any effect of pornography viewing as a function of extreme versus standard, there's no difference. They might be watching more or less in one group, but it doesn't have a different effect on the outcome. And from the likelihood ratio test where I go from freely estimated to constrained, I mean, yeah, nothing. Absolutely nothing. So there's no difference between them. So no effect modification as a function of genre when you account for the gamut of behaviors that people are watching. If we look at those final estimates, I focus specifically in on the receptive unprotected anal intercourse. First column is what you saw before from the final constrained model now. So we've now essentially adjusted for, like in a log linear analysis. We've taken the stratified, looked at their individuals. Once you constrain them, it's now adjusting for that with appropriate variance, and statistical significance, which was only marginally there in the first place, I'll admit, is now marginally gone. So is the question now one of, is it really the amount of porn that you're watching, or would it be more a question of the type of porn that you're watching? And this would be then taking these latent class models and instead of treating it as a stratification factor, incorporating it in as directly as an exposure. And so that'll be some next steps when I get my hands on some more caffeine. Long story short, homogeneity is a strong assumption that should be questioned. You've got these models that are available and that are becoming more predominant in the literature that are pretty robust and very useful, and I think they're a lot of fun. And you have a lot of extensions that can improve your inferences and give you a more robust picture of what's exactly going on in your data. And thank you for not having any questions. It's been wonderful talking to you.
So against his will, we will take questions.
First off, great.
Isn't that a contradiction in terms?
Not at all. I wanted to ask you, you were in your earlier slides, you were kind of turning qualitative data into numbers, percentages, and things like that. Are you just kind of doing that for discussion purposes, or do you generalize off of that, or how do you use that? And I did like your sort of
sequential.
Exploratory. I like that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think any of us in the field would be careful to suggest that any of our data are generalizable unless we're doing a random digit dialing telephone kind of survey. So I would definitely never suggest that the percentages that I provided in terms of responses, in terms of the themes that we came up, are representative of all people living with HIV, and they're certainly limited to our sample. That said, I do think that given that we were going to recruit our sample for our intervention from similar sources, they at least provided us with some indication about what were some of the main sort of things that we wanted to make sure we incorporated into that intervention in order to make it really palatable and usable for our participants. So making sure that we had, some way that people could socialize with each other, really connect with each other, providing some relevant HIV information on there. And we actually did collect some additional information about what topics people would be interested in knowing more about, and we use those topics to really sort of tailor our relevant HIV information on there. And then, of course, we certainly in our consent form, and then we also had ground rules that we posted during our intervention that spoke to issues around confidentiality and privacy concerns. So I think as sort of like data geeks, we like to see those percentages because we can sort of like, oh, this is like really important, that's less important. But definitely I want to say that I would generalize them. So I think I'd be like lashed by my colleagues for saying that. Yeah, exactly.
Lot of social desirability, and I have to throw that data out. So those are my two questions. I can address the social desirability. Part of my training was a lot with psychometrics, and so I was very adamant that we brought in a short form of the Marlowe Crown to measure this. And what I found most interesting overall was I was expecting a distribution that could potentially be right skewed from ranging from 0 to 10, because the conventional wisdom with internet-based research is if people are interacting with just a screen and there are no personal interactions and no identification, then there's no incentive or motivation for social desirability. So I was hoping a very low mean. As it turns out, the central tendency was right at 5, and the distribution was as close to a normal approximation as you could get without faking it, which I found very interesting. And so, to date, all of our quantitative analyses bring the Marlowe Crown in as a covariate to account for that. So that was part one.
Well, and as far as the coding, I program in Stata. And so I think it involves some creative coding, especially not only to compare them, but also to create the flags and then outsheet to an Excel spreadsheet. But I'm currently working on something so that we can kind of standardize it across studies. And for people who aren't necessarily as data savvy, I'm trying to create an Excel spreadsheet where you basically put in the variables that represent those cross-examination sort of variables that I was mentioning, and then it generates the code that can then be copied and put right into Stata. When that's ready, I have no problem sharing it on a website or something like that. I don't have any.
This sounds like a project that I will take back to the mothership, and we can discuss actually trying to put up some of our data analytic resources on the HIPS website through the University of Minnesota portal. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you again for coming and sharing your knowledge with us today. I have a question, again, dealing with fraud. In the work that I do, we have a control intervention group, and I had to go and also manage data to make sure that there would have been any contamination being moved using IP address, contacting the participants to make sure that they weren't using, you know, going in and accessing things that they weren't supposed to. Turns out a lot of the time they didn't have their phone at the right time. They're using the phone from somebody else that was in the group and they didn't get a lot of information. So I wanted to ask you how you went and determined whether or not it was actually true fraud or, you know, friends, community, et cetera.
We used a lot of their payment information. So we looked at their PayPal address. I think, as Alex mentioned earlier, you usually have to verify a PayPal address with a bank account. So that's a good way of seeing if they're distinct people, although people can have multiple bank accounts. And then also, if they requested a check by mail, we looked at the name for the check, too. And that was another thing that we had generate. Again, it was a coding thing, but that was something else that output to the Excel spreadsheet. So I don't know what sort of information you're collecting for payment purposes. I think that's the easiest way to kind of...
Oh, okay. Hearing about the gift card, that's another option. Mm-hmm. However, the population I'm working with is underserved women. Mm-hmm. Women. Mm-hmm. They might be migrant, living out of rent house for a long time, might not have a bank account information. Mm-hmm. Did you use multiple options in this form of payment, or was it strictly PayPal?
We used PayPal or check. But we didn't use cash, so they always had to provide some information for us to provide them with payment.
Yeah, in future study, we'll probably provide more option. But the other thing that we did, because we had a few cases where several people were from one address, and kind of we looked at the area, and then we also looked at the information that they'd given us in more detail, and it was really different people. So we thought it probably is like a public library or a hostel, you know. And so we did take those scenarios into account, and that's where the manual kind of comes in, you know, that the automatic can do up to a point, and then you really need to go into the data and see if this data credible and what are the scenarios that are possible. So we definitely had a few of those, like in larger cities usually, yeah.
It's both an art and a science.
And one last question.
Occurred to me as we were talking about some issues.
Well, I know that one of our ongoing studies that is not related to the porn study actually brought this up as an issue in our last round of data collection, and whether participant payment was actually a necessary factor, or if we try recruiting without any of that, would we still be able to generate enough data points? And it looked like our participation and completion rates were actually on par between payment versus non-payment for surveys. I believe for that study, they actually recruited through Facebook, so this could be in part a factor that they're going to a different source for the population of interest. I know when executing the protocols that we have in the SEM study, they have found fewer cases of fraud, but there are some there. But again, I couldn't really speculate as to motivation for that or multiple completions. One of the issues we ran into, though, with that study was that it ended up getting attacked by something, somebody called a bot. And I'm not, I don't think anyone up here is fully versed in what a bot is, but apparently it was just sort of running random numbers and algorithms and filling out as if it were hundreds of different people and things like that, which I have no idea if that's in any way, shape, or form related to the payment process, but it happened, and that's something we're dealing with on that end.
And I think that was on the study that was not offering payment or very low payment. So it's, you know, automated sometimes, some of the automated kind of attacks on online surveys don't necessarily distinguish on payment or no payment. I know I've done smaller studies where I didn't have any compensation, but they were usually more qualitative in nature and people were more invested.
Thank you guys. Have a great lunch.
Thank you.